Welcome back to Brass Tacks. We have a lot of calls and we have a lot of WhatsApp messages. So let me just take two WhatsApp messages very quickly. The first one, could you ask Dr. Maskell, what about people and companies that own electric vehicles? Mm-hmm. Floor advertised they just bought 8 of these vehicles. I suspect this person is wondering about road tax since there's no road tax.
Yeah.
And you're paying quote-unquote, whatever road tax there was, is to be paid, through purchase of petrol. Mm-hmm. Electric vehicles obviously don't use petrol.
Yeah,
how do you collect money from that?
Yeah, this is an issue. In fact, this is part of where policy making becomes a little complicated, in that we are trying to move towards alternative energy and reduce the cost of our import bill and fuel. So the thing is, Can you incentivize people at this stage to switch to electric vehicles? If you're thinking long term, you have to do it. So the market then is going to have an environment in which those who continue to use fossil would pay higher, and those who move towards electric. But in the long term, this is precisely what you want to do. Now, but the thing is, government itself gets a lot of money from a car. From import stage to fuel. In fact, cars are so vital to economic activity in Barbados, is unbelievable. From the car washer, to the painter, to the mechanic, to the valet services, to gas stations. A car is a real crucial thing in terms of economic activity. Now, therefore, how do we address that? Now, on the electricity, though, there's a VAT. So you still get a little something from that. But are you not incentivizing towards the use of electric cars in concert with your long-term expectation to move from fossil fuel? So it's not a bad thing. The question of road tax, compliance, as I said earlier,
mm-hmm.
Compliance was not good, so we had to find a way to raise and make people make the
compliance. Question has always been asked, though, that the duty on electric cars, I think, is higher.
Yeah, well, I think.
And so, you know, when you say that, maybe we're trying to incentivize.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem I always have is that since the duty is higher, mm-hmm. clearly, that was done, of course, in the last few years.
Yeah.
But if with the duty being higher, there's really no incentive.
Well, eventually.
The incentive actually is no.
Yes.
Because you pay a higher duty up front, but you don't pay any quote-unquote get petrol prices, or which is road tax included. But the duty is higher.
But second, this is the impact of technology on things.
Mm-hmm.
I recall when laptops came up. Laptop in Barbados used to be almost $15,000. You understand? And then over time, so as electric cars become easier to produce than everything else, then we will see a shift towards that sector.
All right, let's move to the second question here. Could you ask the ambassador about school meals? School meals is still $1 per week.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that the meals have changed for a healthier diet, don't think parents would mind. I wonder if she was suggesting there should be an increase.
Yeah.
And she's saying, yes, please. In reality, $1 per week is nothing much. It is less than 25 cents per day. The children buy from the vendors, and the things that the vendors sell cost from $1 up.
Right. Sanka, I've come to recognize that life is relative. $1 may not be anything to you, Sanks, but it may be something to me based on my income. So you can't, again, in making policy, you always have to be very conscious that in light of what the previous caller was saying, that other things are going up, then you have to look more holistically at the entire income and the expenses of the household, as opposed to isolating the school meal costs, you see. So sometimes we can justify subsidizing certain things in public policy, and school meals is one. And the other thing is that if we're going to move more and more towards healthy eating, then we need to sit down and reflect on how the entire school meals thing should be provided in the first place. So this is something we have to think through rather than come willy-nilly and try to make adjustments.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Morning.
Hello, morning. Dr. Maskell. My point has to do with national insurance. In fact, you were saying earlier that national insurance will be a wash of the cash, right?
Yeah. Eventually.
Eventually.
Now, we have, as you would know very well, we have an underdeveloped capital market. And in fact, two pillars of any capital market, as you'd agree, would be Gilt Edge stock and blue chip equities, you agree. Now, in Barbados, we have no equity market at all. So in Barbados, we are all, not only specific to national insurance, but in fact, I could apply to all investors. The only thing we can invest in, in fact, we only investment available are naturally bank deposits, or our deposits generally were paying very low rates. So the only thing left for us was to invest in government security. Mm. Now, government security should be gilt edge, as you would, but which means that should be the safest form of investment, because government will never default on interest and capital payments. Mm. Now, this is not the case in Barbados. Right. Because our government security cannot qualify for gilt edge status. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, I would say that our government security in Norway can be classified as what we will call greenfield projects. Mm-hmm. Now, so what would be the position of national insurance now going forward if this large amount of money to invest? Where will they invest it?
Well, the thing is innovation. That's why I said earlier that you need competent people on that board. Can you get involved in other areas? In light of the fact that government's capital works program may be restricted over the next couple of years, can the NAS itself maybe see opportunities in real estate and other such areas? These are things for the board to decide. And this is where you need the micro level data to be able to make these decisions.
But what I'm saying is that pension funds should not be invested in high-risk projects. And now, in fact, my point is not specific to national insurance, but what about the life companies and the large number of pension funds that are looking for funds every month, for securities every month to invest in?
You satisfied that the only thing you should be investing in would be government securities?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that pension funds should never be invested in high-risk projects.
And what is a high-risk project? In real estate?
Some of them can be.
You think so?
I'm not saying some of them can be high risk.
No, I ask if you really believe what you
say. Yes, there's some that can be high risk.
Which ones?
Yeah.
In Barbados? Who has made money in Barbados? Who are the big boys in Barbados?
There's some that make money, yes, and so on.
Not some. I answer your question. Who really make the money in Barbados? If you have some money, now, where you put it in?
I don't know where to put it, to be honest.
You sure?
I don't know where to put it.
Are you trying to avoid my question?
If you're telling me that I'm going to a housing project, what about the people who will qualify for mortgages? I will have to know the number of people who will be out there buying houses to be able to go in this housing project. So how can I be assured that it will be a profitable venture?
It can only be housing. I'm saying that we intend to see an entire shift in... tourism.
And
tourism going forward is going to need additional finance.
But anyhow, tourism is a high-risk area.
No, you say that, but I'm saying if you carve out some niche areas, mm-hmm. you see, almost in every area of business, there are people who succeed and do well because they go outside of the box. So if you think that you can just do the ordinary stuff and continue to just the sea and the sand and not become innovative even in that industry, then you're on the wrong path.
Another point is this. I've heard people talk about investing overseas. But as you know, there are many disadvantages investing overseas you have to look at. Uh-huh. And in fact, I heard something about some return earned on overseas investment. But I would like them to tell me what was the net rate, because do not forget you have to employ a broker, mm-hmm. you have in costs involving the funds. For instance, if you're getting dividends from the United States, you have bank costs involved with converting the funds into Barbados dollars when you receive them. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of other things. I could go through a whole myriad of investments. When I was doing investment, I could tell you about that a disadvantage associated with overseas investment. I mean, yes, the advantage is because you can get better returns in other parts of the world. That's a fact. There are advantages, but there are also severe disadvantages.
But that's the nature of investment. It's called risk and reward. You need to search around the world because there's now a freer flow. When I say a freer, I mean we got factor and all these things, but you can now move money more easily. I'm not talking about bad money, good money, more easily in search of proper investments.
I know that, for example, there are some, unit trusts and so on in Britain and saying that you can get very good investments on. However, there may be high risk, have a certain amount of risk involved in them.
But once it's giving good return, there's going to be some risk associated with it.
Yeah, fair enough. But
and that's the nature of investment.
But, so that's what I'm concerned. I'm very concerned about our national insurance fund.
What are you concerned about? Because,
yeah, because
it has not been compromised with that restructuring. In fact, if you check,
but listen, you listed all the concerns that I had. Look, you talk about government inability to pay, that government did not pay their contribution.
Under the IMF program now, you cannot build up arrears. So the government
has to pay people
NAS contributions. Now, think about that. And the flow of funds that will go to the NAS every month. Think about the outstanding $460 million that we have to get paid back in the next 4 years. So that's what I'm saying to you. You can't. Okay. All right. Go on.
Next point is the rent due. Now, I heard one gentleman, I think he directed finance and plans some time ago, when they were opening the project at Bridgefield, which was funded by IMF.
NAS?
NAS money. Sorry. He was defending government's right to use NAS funds to build building. Mm-hmm. Now, if they're not getting the rent, you're going to assure us now that the NAS will get its money for the rent, like the building and warranty, you understand, and the others.
Yeah, but it's the same government that refused, that was not paying the NAS.
Right.
That's the whole problem.
You can be sure now that all that will be done.
No, it has to. You cannot build up arrears on the NAS program. There can be no falsifying of government's accounts. You have to show the real picture. So if you owe people money, you have to pay them. You cannot build up arrears. Yes.
Before you ask the question, let's take a commercial break. Let's take a commercial break. You hold on the line. Just don't go away. Welcome back to Brass Tacks. Sir, are you still there?
Yes.
You want to ask one last question?
Uh-huh. Yeah, my question is, I would like to ask Mr. Maskell, what is the upfront fee for the MF loan?
The upfront fee? No, man. Well, the truth is, Barbados is a member of the IMF. They got something called special drawing rights based on...
Yep.
So Barbados is a very small member, and it's then called the quota. So the fees are insignificant. I don't even think that...
Let me tell you why.
And the loan is 1%, by the way.
No, let me tell you. Now, that's the point I'm making. Mm-hmm. The loan is 1%, but I'm going to ask you, from anybody who's familiar with banking would know this. Mm-hmm. In addition to the quotas, MS is financed by members' quotas,
and it
also raises money in the capital markets of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good. No, that's why I raised the question.
Right.
Now, if like any bank, I'm a banker, like any financial institute, I have to borrow money.
Mm-hmm.
No, they have to issue make bond issues. So they have to pay issuing houses.
Right.
They have to pay interest rate to the bondholders. They have to pay costs. For instance, all these people traveling to and fro, all the they have to make a lot of
money.
They have to be paid for. Who will pay for those?
No, of course the membership, and loans come with costs. But you can imagine.
Right.
You can imagine what you just told me, though, buddy.
Yeah, it was that.
Over the last 10 years, you had the lowest interest rates in the world ever. You know that?
Yes,
you're a banker.
I'm aware of that.
And you can imagine Barbados having to borrow at 11 and 12%.
I remember. Credit Suisse loan.
Lord, man. Think about it. That at the time when international interest rates were at the lowest, the Barbados government was borrowing at 11%. That's unbelievable.
There's a bit of foolishness that I never understood, even when I was in banking. Why is it a weak customer you charge a higher rate? And in fact, similarly, they decide in these agreements when you have a downgrade.
But I mean, we just talk about risk.
That makes sense.
But you answer why?
No, but what I'm saying is, if you ask a weak customer to pay a higher rate, knowing that he doesn't have the money to pay.
Why would you lend in the first place? Unless you believe, right? But what I'm saying, but having loaned him, right? Then you impose a higher rate.
That's the nature of life.
All right, sir, thank you very much for your question. Just do a follow-up here. On the WhatsApp, this person is saying, if the NAS is going to be flooded with cash, why the increase in contribution? Go after the defaulters. Go after the small man that's not paying their share. Why are the people who pay being made to pay more to cover the revenue loss because of the defaulters?
Well, the major defaulter was government. We accept that. There's no private sector company that owes the NAS $460 million.
Mm-hmm.
We agree?
Mm-hmm.
And then I hope she, whoever it is, not confusing the contribution of the health levy with this, because that the NS is just being used as an agent through which the money is collected to be passed on to the QEH. But talking about default, that's why we're in this, because our government was defaulting on its IMF, on its NAS payments. So the issue of default started ever since.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phone lines.
Hi, good morning, Sanka.
Good morning,
Eden Rogers here. Good morning, Ambassador Marco.
Good morning.
How are you,
I just caught the back end of some of your comments in relation to electric vehicles and the fiscal implications of them. And I'm actually heartened that you've raised this issue on the national radio, because it's one of the things that we in Breer have been pushing for further analysis on.
Yes.
This is the whole question of looking at establishing some sort of sustainable energy fiscal strategy working group.
Yes.
A lot of government revenue is directly tied to the fossil fuel industry. Not only in terms of electricity, but particularly in transportation.
Yes.
And one of the things we've been saying is that we really needed to dig a lot deeper, because over the last 3 years, technocrats and government has identified that for every 20% reduction on average we would have in our fossil fuel usage, there will be a cumulative commensurate reduction by almost $50 million annually in government revenue.
I don't have the data, but I don't doubt it.
Yeah, but this is information you can verify with them. So my question really is that we need to have a holistic view of how we're going to look at making this sustainable energy transition. Yeah. Because I think one of the challenges the previous government had is that the Ministry of Finance was reluctant to do anything significantly in the energy sector as it relates to renewables because of this fiscal situation. Now, we believe that there are solutions to it, and a lot of it revolves around the transportation sector, particularly the public transportation sector. And I know there's been a lot of discussion surrounding the whole question of increased bus fare.
Yes.
I'm aware of the situation government is in, but I'm also looking at the social impact of increased bus fare.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done some provisional analysis. If you had to have a $3 increase in bus fare, say bus fare goes to $3. For a hotel worker, at least 15,000 of them are low-paid workers working for $3.50 maybe a week. You're really looking, depending on whether they catch two buses or four buses a day, almost a 10 to 20% reduction in their take-home pay. Now, our solution to this is that we've met with persons in the public transportation sector. They've identified maintenance and fuel costs as amounting to close to 30% of their ongoing operating expenses annually. We're saying to government, look, we have to find some sort of strategy where we can retrofit our public transportation fleet to more sustainable or electrified powered vehicles. That is whether through a combination of importing buses or even manufacturing buses and bringing in just the electrical powertrain here. And our solution has been, look, if we can reduce, because the data is out there to prove that a conversion from a fuel bus to an electric bus would translate into 60 to 65% savings on just the fuel and the service and maintenance. That would translate to, say, roughly $20,000. I was saying, if we can say to the public transportation operators, if we can give you a 20%, a $20,000 saving in that, your operating expenses, reasonably government can look for 40, 50% of that. I'm no economist, Mr. Masco, but this is some of the deep analysis that we need to look at.
You sound deeper than the economist.
Yeah, because if you do some of this deep analysis, you can possibly come up with win-win strategies that can still reduce the social impact. The second point that I want to raise, and then I'll let you comment, is where we are right now in our whole sustainable energy push. And I've been on record publicly of stating to, this is before the general election, in an article that Breer printed in the press, we need to be cautious, and this was a warning to the upcoming government, whoever that was, do not discard a lot of the sound technical work that was undertaken, not by the last government, under the last government, because government is a continuum.
Correct.
And I raise that specifically to what I noticed to be some silence on two critical issues that the renewable energy sector requires urgently. One, deliberations and finalization of the extension of the utilities license, which is critical for anybody seeking to invest in the sector, because their license expires in 10 years, and from a legal perspective, they can't contract with anyone for any long-term power purchase period beyond that until they know what their status is.
Mm-hmm.
The second point has to do with the whole question of a tariff study that was commissioned by government. Hired a consultant, consultant was paid, there were public meetings with stakeholders recommending what the market should look like in terms of pricing of renewable energy.
Right.
The movement on that study seems to be somewhat delayed.
Mm.
Credit to Minister Abrams. I know he has a lot of headache dealing with the sewage issue,
mm.
but this is something the sector is awaiting a bated breath, and I would really like to hear some feedback from you on that or engage with you further on those two issues, because they right now are the big clogs in the pipe to getting the alternative sector going, which everyone identifies as being critical to a part of this recovery strategy.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak for the Minister of Energy, though. But you're sounding as though you've done your homework. And
well, I've been working around this sector for the last 8 years.
Right. And I'm going to jokingly answer your question.
Sure.
Are you B or D? Don't answer. I'm only making sport because I'm saying.
Don't answer that, Rogers.
What I'm saying is that, and this is now for a previous caller. Mr. Rogers, you've expressed an interest in this area. You've demonstrated competence. Should you not be used by any government to carry this process forward? You with me? Because we are too small a country now to be picking here and there. What we need are people who are competent in their areas. You mean, don't answer the question, Roger. He was just making sport on that.
I will answer it with
you
a joke.
Yeah.
I'll answer it with a joke. Every evening when two of my children request anything from me to eat and I go in the fridge,
right.
Nobody, either B or D, extends a hand from the inside and offers me anything.
Thank you, man. You understand what I'm saying now? So listen, continue to do the work you're doing. And I know that the government has all intentions of changing towards alternative energy, and they've set dates for it, the turning this thing around. But we know, because we are fairly familiar with some of the data, that fossil fuel brings in a lot of revenue for government.
It does.
And therefore, the thing that has to be done, therefore, we need a comprehensive tax reform to be able
Correct.
To accommodate the changing out of the economy towards an economy that does not rely as heavily on fossil fuels. So this work has to be done. But it is a must, because we stand to benefit substantially from it. Right?
And there's a lot
I hope that you play
your
part in it. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I have been here, willing to work with all and sundry.
And don't move. Just stick to the truth. Tell the truth, and that's all you need.
Correct.
All right.
Correct.
Aiden, thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Good.
We'll take a commercial break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Brass Tacks. This is Sanka Price with you. Dennis Johnson is our producer, the technical director. And in the studio, we have Ambassador Dr. Clyde Maskell, the economic advisor to the Minister of Finance. And he's focusing on the BERT program, the NAS, and anything else you want to ask about regarding the economy. And we go back to the phone lines. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Price, Mr. Maskell, Mr. Johnson. I am calling in connection with this BERT program.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst I understand, I don't have a question, but I can just voice my concern.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst I understand the need to get the economy back on track to a level of sustainability, et cetera, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
My concern is that this measure that was implemented by the government to do with the debentures, the securities,
mm-hmm.
To me it was so draconian, and I even sometimes term it as like a hostile takeover, to be honest, because mm-hmm. what it has essentially done to me is that it has taken away the only income I was getting, because I'm not of pensionable age and I'm not employed, right?
Yeah.
And that was the only income I was getting, and it has been cut. And I mean, where has that left me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the whole way it was done, because like when I really think of it, as most people calling in talking about the non-contributory pensioners,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been paying from day one all my life, mm-hmm. you know, preparing and trying to put myself and my situation in the best possible you know, way that I can.
Right.
And only now for this thing to be thrust upon me and how it was done, I'm asking in my mind, wasn't there any other way for that group of people who fall into the category like myself?
Mm.
Couldn't something be done for those individuals?
Yeah, and a very legitimate concern. The thing with public policy is that it is never perfect. But the most important thing about it is equity. So that when you introduce a public policy, you have always to be concerned about the incidence of it. How would it affect individual A versus individual B? In fact, just by way of example, the income tax system is designed to help people at the lower end. So that's why you have $25,000 with no income tax. And then you have a smaller rate and it gets higher as you go up. And this is to do with being equitable. Now, the thing is that with the best will in the world, what the debt restructuring was seeking to do is to recover $500 million per year, because you cannot continue increasing taxes. You can't cut social services. You can't send home 4,000 or 5,000 civil servants. So the next best thing in the room was this. And just let me explain it to you. There are four categories of government expenditure: wages and salaries. And the truth is that over the last 5 to 6 years, the previous government held that fairly constant by what we call attrition. The interest payments is the next category, and that is the payment of interest on debt. Then you have what we call transfers and subsidies. Now, in spite of the last government containing central government employment, they then found a way to expand employment among the state-owned enterprises, which we saw in transfers and subsidies. And the final category is goods and services. So when we sat down to think about how we can address the situation, it could not be done only through raising taxes. That's inappropriate. But when you look at the other categories, can you reduce your wages and salaries in central government even more? That was hard to do. Can you look at transfers and subsidies? We have to do that because most of the state-owned enterprises, such as the Barbados Water Authority, every month, the Barbados Water Authority has $10 million more in expenses than revenue. That's unsustainable. So the only other category, and the largest after, was the $750 in interest that we were paying on debt. And then we sought to look at that too and made this suggestion up front, that since Barbadians were seduced into buying bonds, the savings bonds, because at the time our interest on deposit was less than 1%, in fact closer to zero, but the government was offering a 5.5% on bonds, so people switched to bonds. We did what you call ring fence, insulated them from this adjustment. That narrowed the gap, but we were still searching for $500 million. So we come to the debentures, and we reduced the interest costs that government was paying substantially, and it is burdensome. And then we tried to expand the maturity period in order to reduce the overall cost of servicing the debt. Problem is that in doing this, each and every individual, then you have to take account of individual B's circumstances, A's circumstances, and therefore we would suffer and struggle with people like yourself who feel, and rightly so, that to carry that burden is difficult. Now, it's very difficult.
More than difficult.
Yeah. But we still understand that bigger picture where we are trying to secure your future, trying to secure the future of your grandchildren and your children, is now paramount.
What alternative to that structure?
There's no other way here, because when you look at all the other categories, you would have to send home quite a few thousand people. Now, let me say this. The current wages bill in central government is about $800 and something million.
It was annually?
Annually. Overall, we have a wages bill of about $1.2 billion. You're talking about 30, 35,000 public servants. If you try to take $500 million away from that, you can see what you're talking about in terms of people that you will have to send home. And then the thing about that individual is that you have to look at the multiplier effect. Is that individual the only person? Is that individual responsible for three or four others? And therefore, you begin to understand the magnitude of the problem.
Is this why, sorry to break it, but is this why the Prime Minister, I know Dr. Greenwich, this is his name, Dr. Greenwich, is saying that there's not going to be any major layoffs?
No, we can't afford major layoffs. And therefore, the adjustment, the only other category was saying, now, the thing is, you would know, you heard something called strip bonds. What's happening, my dear, is that the face value that you have on your bond, say, $100. Now, typically, you only have access to that face value at the end of the maturity period. So if your bond is to mature in the next 5-10 years, that's when you get access. What the government is actually doing is that the government is using a principle called strip bonds. And this is going to happen after the IMF program. So that from the fifth year, and for the pensioners from next year, you're going to be allowed, literally, to strip off a piece of your bond. This now gives you access to greater cash flow. And this is going to occur, the stripping of the bond is going to occur to the end of maturity.
And that is the alternative for her.
That's the alternative because...
Are you saying this is happening after 5 years?
Yes. Now, what happened is that, again, the whole thing is this. To make that program doable, that homemade program doable, we had to ensure that that debt restructuring is sustainable. And to do the debt restructuring, we need to be in a position where the excess that we get from the whole fiscal reform will now contribute to paying down of the debt. And that is where, when you stop to, as a policymaker, you have to think also with your heart. I've had individuals who were already come to me and explain their plight and their condition. And I think, I know for a fact that the Prime Minister, even though you can't at all compromise your homemade program with the IMF, you still have to have a heart, and therefore there are things that we can think of and we're thinking of. All right? That's as far as we can go, but we can't compromise that.
Do you have a follow-up question? Okay. We take another call. Thank you very much for holding. You're on the air.
You're welcome. A very good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Hello?
Yes. Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Yes, how are you all doing?
Fine, thank
you. Good.
Okay. Now, I want to wish success to the Prime Minister of the Liberal Party, Dr. Maskell and his team, in debt restructuring. Yeah. Well, it will kind of bring about some sort of stability to the economy. This is my way of thinking.
Yeah.
Right? Now, Miss Dr. Maskell.
Yeah.
If this debt restructuring, we're talking about foreign debt and domestic debt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, let us look here, before I go to the domestic debt, I want to steer clearly here that the majority of Asians would have to more or less, the slogan is that we are all in this together.
Mm-hmm.
That's the slogan.
Many hands make light work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we still have to be conscious of the fact that there are many who are going to be going through a lot of suffering.
Yeah.
Like you're hearing them now one by one coming out.
Mm-hmm.
With the amount of taxes.
Right.
Now, I would say that you all have been placed in a a position here today by the previous administration.
Correct.
To do a lot of cleaning up, a lot of hard work.
Yes.
Because when you look at it, when we go to the domestic debt, you just mentioned something like 800 the
interest costs. The interest cost on the debt? Like he dropped out.
They call it dropped out. Just let me just take it from him. Hopefully, sir, if you're hearing, please call back. You said he made the point, we are all in this together, and you're saying many hands make light work. Mm-hmm. One of the concerns that the public has is that we have all these ministers and we have yourself. Mm-hmm. You're getting a salary. Right. And since your ambassador, you must be getting a big salary. So we need to deal with that. How could all be in this together, you get a big salary?
Actually, sometimes I wonder about myself. I was in a pretty safe haven at the university. It would have really served my interest financially to stay at the University of West Indies. First of all, there was an exodus of people retiring. There were openings for upward mobility in the faculty, in the department. But it would have been difficult to resist the opportunity to come and make a difference. And therefore, again, as is apparently my want, I had to make this sacrifice in order to do so. So I could not put myself first, that's what I'm saying, because it would be much safer. I would have had a health plan, you know, have to pay for your own. In terms of, I would become pensionable again down the road after X amount of years, and there would have been opportunities for increases once you do work commensurate with to justify it. In this situation here, this is really a solid position for the next whatever years. In fact, we only have 3-year contracts. So again, you bring yourself in a position where you can be, after 3 years, you can go. But truth be told, it has to be looked at in relation to what is required and what has to be done, and the moment in time, the difficulty. This is perhaps the greatest challenge that Barbados would have ever had. And I must say this. So far, the leadership of the Prime Minister has been exemplary. First of all, her energy, the preparedness of the Prime Minister, the inspiration that she gives, and the courage. In every sense, it is epic. And therefore, we must understand that there's no way that you could have carried this without having the kind resources around you in order to be able to deal specifically with issues and then to grant individuals some rights, you know, to be innovative and creative, but to meet expectations. And it is on that basis, therefore, that you have to see this thing. This is a big project called Project Barbados that has to be addressed from several different facets and cannot be seen purely in terms of somebody being a consultant, but what is the worth of the individual?
And what about addressing the whole thing of the
size of
the cabinet? But before we do that, we'll take a commercial break, and when we come back, we'll deal with that.
Okay.